Science Talks is recorded at the Legacy Music Recording Studio in Lewisville, Texas. Ben Robertson is our sound engineer, and you've been listening to Becerro, composed by Brian Pinkelman and performed by Brian Pinkelman on piano and Logan Pinkelman on the bassoon. Welcome to Science Talks, a podcast where we discuss big topics in science and speak with experts about their latest publications. My name is Dr. Deanna Soper, and I am an associate professor of biology at the University of Dallas. Each episode on Science Talks will feature one scientist and break down a recent publication. I aim to bridge the gap between the conversations that only scientists have and assist in distributing that information to a wider general audience. In this episode, we are with Samuel Hurst, a PhD candidate and NSF graduate research fellow in Dr. Mark Margray's lab at the University of South Florida. Samuel graduated from Brigham Young University in 2021 with a Bachelor of Science in Genetics, Genomics, and Biotechnology. Samuel already has four peer-reviewed publications, with his most recent manuscript being published less than 2 weeks ago. He is interested in the evolution of venom and uses a variety of techniques to investigate venom composition and variation across species and populations. Today, we will be focusing on discussing a paper called Island Biogeography and Competition: Drive Rapid Venom Complexity Evolution Across Rattlesnakes, published in April 2025 in the peer-reviewed journal Evolution. This study investigates how ecological parameters influence the evolution of venom in rattlesnake species across the islands of the Gulf of California. You will learn about how ecology and evolution are intertwined and how direct species interactions can influence important life-dependent traits. I should note, this podcast is separate from my teaching and research at the University of Dallas. However, it is part of my effort to distribute both scientific knowledge and an understanding of the scientific process to the general public. And now we will begin our chat with Samuel Hurst. Welcome, Samuel, to Science Talks.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here and talk a little bit about my research.
Yes, it's nice to have you. So one of the things I noticed on your paper was that there's many international collaborators. How has international collaboration influenced the work that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really great question. You know, I would say like one of the most amazing parts of doing science is the people that you meet. And international collaboration has certainly been a part of that. I've been kind of fortunate to have these international collaborations presented to me through other collaborators from my current PI in my lab, and sort of his journey and his academic journey with other researchers and collaborators, and kind of through that, you know, it's allowed me to meet a lot of these different international researchers, a lot primarily in Mexico, which is where I do primarily where I do my research, especially for my dissertation on these islands in the Gulf of California. So I've had a great opportunity to form collaborations both within that sort of group that's assisting us with this research project, and also their collaborators who have been involved in these systems. So there's been lots of, you know, amazing collaborations, kind of a network, almost a spider web, you know, it keeps expanding out. The more people you meet, the more you have opportunity to meet other people. And, you know, that's expanding across other countries too. So that's one of the greatest parts of doing science, I think.
Yes, I agree. I have multiple collaborations with multiple different institutions and people all over the world, and it's really nice to be able to meet this rich body of people that come from various backgrounds that help us in our work. So tell me how this paper came to be. What's the story behind the formulation of this particular study?
Yeah, so I'd say it actually began a little bit before me, at least with this specific paper and the research with it. So as part of my journey into a PhD, one thing that I was sort of prioritizing for my education was making sure that I was a part of a project that had some good funding behind it. I think for me, that was important because it would just allow me to, you know, start my PhD, get going in the research, be able to have, you know, the funding and means necessary to do the things that I wanted. And then, of course, I wanted to be able to enjoy the project. So this project was really, and the sort of idea behind this really actually started with my current PI for my PhD back when he was doing the postdoc at Clemson University. So him and his collaborator there, Jason Strickland, who's now currently at the University of South Alabama, they both kind of came up with this study and this idea about using island biogeography theory across these islands. My current PI, Mark Margris, a lot of his dissertation work was involved on rattlesnakes in the Florida islands. And so it was another island system to which you could expand to. It's a lot more islands with, you know, a variety of different rattlesnake species. And so it was really this and a model environment for looking at island biogeography theory in this sort of context of rattlesnakes and venom. And so, you know, definitely a lot of the, you know, that credit in terms of where this study sort of was born was with my current PI and his postdoc at Clemson University. And, you know, I've had the opportunity to expand upon it, but that was sort of the beginning of it. And he was fortunate to get a grant funded through the National Geographic Society on this project. So that was the main funder of this project.
That's amazing. And I'm so grateful to organizations like National Geographic and even governmental funding like NSF in order to be able to fund important work that helps us to better understand nature. And I think that's something that really should be highlighted here. So describe for us what the general theme of the paper, what was the big question that you were addressing?
Yeah, so it really starts with again, as I highlighted, island biogeography theory. So for those who are unfamiliar, this was really one of an important groundbreaking ecological theory coined by E.O. Wilson and Robert MacArthur in the 60s. And it was sort of born out of this desire to bring a bit more quantitative theory into the world of ecology. You know, a lot of sciences, it's chemistry, you know, physics, they have a lot of these theories. And it's harder to do that with ecology. There's just so many things going on in terms of evolution and ecology. But that was really their desire. And so they took this sort of idea of islands and being able to predict biodiversity on these islands and also habitats as kind of fragmented habitats as sort of islands, right? And so islands or fragmented habitats kind of serving that same purpose. But the idea was to look at how island biogeography theory or islands, how biodiversity varies across these different islands. That was sort of their goal. And so you have these sort of predictions based on probability of colonization and extinction that occurs on these islands and predicting, being able to predict, you know, species biodiversity on these islands based on how large that island is, how isolated an island is. And so it was this quantitative theory that was able to make these predictions using those island characteristics. Now, with that in mind, we have some good understanding about how this theory can apply to biodiversity. But kind of building upon that, our question was, well, can we use this to also look at certain traits and the evolution of traits, specifically traits that are involved in species interactions? Because, you know, if a trait is involved in multiple species interactions, we could assume that it will evolve to be equipped to deal with all those different species interactions. And so venom, snake venom, was a really good system in order to do that, to answer that question at whether we can predict trait evolution using these predictions of island biogeography theory. So that was really the big question. Can we use, you know, characteristics of islands like island area, isolation, the ages of islands, how those islands formed, and even some other ecological characteristics to predict trait evolution in a complex trait that's involved in species interactions?
And you are mentioning the fact that that this is a proxy for habitat fragmentation. So how can human-induced habitat alterations create islands of suitable habitat?
Yeah, well, you think about, you know, these habitats, especially as humans continue to expand, as we continue to destroy habitats, whether it be our need for resources or our need for places to live. You know, we build, and what ends up happening is we actually can isolate certain habitats. Whether you think about building a big road with fences on either side, it's much more difficult for species in each of those habitats that may be divided by that human-created thing, whether it be a road or a fence, to cross between those two habitats. And you know, that can vary for organism, but, you know, things like snakes or things like, you know, mammals that may have difficult traversing these habitats, we can create these almost islands from just our infrastructure that we build, just from habitat destruction. You know, if you have a big forest patch over here and like agricultural land in the middle and a big forest patch over there, if you think about it, we've really created this sort of island forest that may prevent some species from being able to migrate between habitats. And so you get these isolated habitats that almost function similarly to islands that have a, you know, body of water between them, just unsuitable habitat for species that they may have difficulty crossing or migrating between.
So you've explained a little bit as to why you chose venom, but you also in the introduction talk about the fact that it's a functional trait. So can you define for us what is a functional trait?
Yeah, so a functional trait is really one that is involved in species interactions, and that is involved for their species survival, or in other words, their survival and ability to reproduce. So snake venom as a trait, or as a functional trait, it has to be injected into another organism in order for it to actually work. So it serves a specific function. You know, there's other traits that are important to organism survival. We could think of like body size or things like that. But a functional trait is really specifically involved in that interaction. We can also think of like beaks with birds and their ability to obtain food. So it's a trait that is important in that survival and that species interaction.
And why, can you dig into a little bit more why then venom makes an interesting trait to investigate these eco-evolutionary interactions?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's to first define what venom is. Venom is this complex cocktail of different toxins that multiple animals, you know, we can think of snakes, so there's insects or other marine fauna that can use it in order to subdue and consume prey. And so this venom, it's composed of a bunch of unique components, each with different properties and that induce different physiological reactions, but all of the collective function to subdue and digest prey. And so for this reason, venom is a trait that's involved in this direct species interaction. Like I said, it doesn't have any purpose really outside of that species interaction of consuming prey. There are some defense mechanisms in certain snakes, but in most cases, it's for that feeding, primarily for that feeding mechanism. So and we have that. Oh, go ahead.
No, fine. It's fine. Go ahead.
Another aspect of venom is it's genetically tractable, meaning basically all of the genes that are involved in expressing or in contributing to that venom phenotype, to that venom trait, are only expressed in the venom gland and are only expressed to create that venom. So there's something in genetics we think about often called pleiotropy. It's basically involvement of multiple traits from a single gene. With venom, we don't really have that interaction. Those genes that are specific for the venom phenotype are just expressed in the venom gland and are just for that venom. So it creates this sort of isolated, you know, system where we can study those molecular interactions with the environment and things like that. So it's that genetic tractability is a really positive part about this system. And it's also complex, right? If you just have a trait that's controlled by a single gene, there's only so much that you can do to alter that trait. By having a really complex phenotype, there can be a lot of very specific and nuanced differences and changes to that gene that contribute to changes in the trait.
So that actually leads me to a question about the evolution of venom itself. So if you have single genes that code only for venom, which is actually quite rare, you know, usually genes are pleiotropic and that they're going to have multiple effects across multiple phenotypes. Where did venom initially come from, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that is certainly something that is up to debate on the sort of evolution of venom. But it really was co-opted from the immune system. So a lot of these venom genes actually have sort of gene ancestry in immune genes. Mm. And so, yeah, I guess the best answer to that question was the co-option of immune genes into being able to, you know, disrupt the physiological functions of other organisms. I mean, if you think about immune genes, they're already good at disrupting things. They're already good at attacking and destroying things. So, you know, in order to evolve to they've been able to evolve in order to attack, you know, the physiology of other organisms as well.
That makes a lot of sense. So can you explain figure one? It's really interesting that you all put a figure in the introduction, but I love prediction figures. So I'll go ahead and actually share my screen at this point so that we can walk through figure one, because I think really understanding the predictions that you very clearly lay out in the introduction will be helpful later on down the road when we're talking about the results. So in figure one, you have four panels. And can you talk a little bit about each of those?
Absolutely. Yeah, so we did want to make it very clear what our predictions and our hypotheses were in this study. That was one of the really, I guess, cool strengths of this study, was the ability to make these really solid predictions. And of course, they originate in island biogeography theory. So as I mentioned, there's predictions of island biogeography theory based on island characteristics, primarily island size, its distance or its isolation from the mainland, its age. And so based on those predictions, we created these predictions for venom, and specifically a metric we call venom complexity, which is basically the number and abundance of unique toxins within the venom phenotype of a snake. And so for this first panel, we'll just kind of go through the figure panel by panel. We have panel A that predicts that venom complexity will be positively correlated with island area. And this is simply because island area, due to island biogeography theory, predict that larger islands are going to have a more diverse number of species, or more increased species biodiversity, and therefore greater potential prey diversity. So kind of an integral setup from this was a study from a researcher, Dr. Matt Holding, in 2021 in the journal PNAS, which found that venom complexity in vipers was positively correlated with dietary diversity. So a snake that has a bunch of different dietary types, whether it's, you know, eating mammals and lizards and marine organisms, is going to have a more complex venom than, say, a snake that is only eating just one type of mouse. So that venom complexity is related to dietary complexity. And so if on a larger island we have greater species biodiversity, we assume that we have potential greater prey diversity. Now, in an ideal world in this study, we would have gone out, found every single prey item of every snake on every island, but that would take at least 20 more PhDs or something to do that for each of those islands, because that would be a lot of work. Snakes don't feed very frequently. It's even all of the organisms on these islands haven't been super well characterized in terms of the mammals and different invertebrates and things like that. So that, with an ideal world, what we would have is this perfect diet information on the snakes. But here we have to rely on some assumptions, and that was important for us to acknowledge, is we are assuming that island biogeography theory is accurately predicting species biodiversity. And so that leads to that first panel, that we have greater venom complexity on larger islands due to greater potential prey diversity. And then similarly with island isolation, more isolated islands have a fewer number of potential species, and therefore a fewer number of potential prey items for these snakes. So lower venom complexity. And then age, you know, as islands go along, species go extinct on these islands, so greater potential reduction in prey diversity for these snakes, so less venom complexity. And then D is almost our more competing hypothesis, in that if there are competitors, that are on these islands with these snakes, specifically other rattlesnake species. As I mentioned, some of these islands have more than one different type of rattlesnake species. If there's another competitor, that's going to lead to potential specialization, you know, rather than all of them competing for the same prey items. Potentially one competitor is going to maybe go for these two or three species, and then, you know, the other one is going to go for the other species that it isn't going for. And so that competition would lead to reduced venom complexity in these snakes.
And that's what you meant by congenerics. Can you define that term for everyone?
Yeah, congenerics are just closely related species or taxa. So in this case, we have four different species of rattlesnakes or rattlesnake complexes. And so a congeneric would just be the other rattlesnake species from that. It's within the same, in this case, the same genus. So those are closely competing congenerics, as we define here.
And then can you go in, we'll migrate into the methods. Where did you do your sampling and how did all of that happen?
Yeah, so our sampling took place in Baja California. There's a peninsula, the Baja California Peninsula. It's just south of California, USA. If you just get in your car in Los Angeles and keep driving south, you'll find yourself disconnected from mainland Mexico on the peninsula of Baja. It's a really spectacular place, full of amazing marine life, and it's really one of those just unique biological regions in the world. And part of that are the diversity of islands, both in the Pacific Ocean, but also within the Gulf of California, which is the area between mainland Mexico and the peninsula of Baja California. So within the Gulf of California, there are 20 islands where rattlesnake species have been found, and it may have one, most islands have one to two species of rattlesnake. There is one that has three species of rattlesnakes. But yeah, those were the islands that we used. There's 20 islands. Across the time that I've been a PhD student, we've been able to, at this point, successfully sample about 11 of those. And the hope is, of course, in the future to tackle the remaining islands to include and to look at in that work. But for now, we have these 11 islands where we've sampled these four different species across these islands.
It looks beautiful. I see the pictures here in figure two, and it's really pretty. I can see that. It makes me want to dive there. Are you a scuba diver?
I am, yeah. I didn't get to go scuba diving, but certainly had the chance to go snorkeling with sea lions and snorkeling at a lot of the reefs that are just found on these islands, and fishing as well. And it is... as far as a marine biologist would go, this is one of the most just perfect locations in the world, and great for snake scientists too. But I think a marine scientist definitely has their, that's one of the best places in the world for them. So.
Excellent. So you collected these snakes, and how did that, most people probably would be interested. How does that process work? Because I personally would be scared to collect a rattlesnake, and I'm a biologist.
Yeah. So I'll preface this with the fact that I did not start my PhD as a snake scientist. I was a geneticist, as you found within my undergrad. I had no research experience with snakes, let alone venomous snakes. So when I first started in the lab with Mark Margris, a lot of that first year was training on venomous snakes, both in how to find them effectively. You know, we're living in Florida. We have the opportunity to go out and practice. There's islands close to us in the Tampa region where we can go and catch rattlesnakes. And so I had the opportunity to at least do that a little bit to get a feel for finding snakes on islands. It's very different from Florida to Mexico, but sort of that experience helped for sure. And then we're trained on how to safely capture them using proper equipment like hooks and such. And then we I was trained on how to extract samples, including venom and blood from the rattlesnakes, as well as getting all these other measurements, and really all while doing so, how to do it safely. And one of the things we use are these big clear glass plastic tubes. So once we find the snake and we're able to safely capture it, make sure it's safe, we place them in these long plastic tubes that kind of isolates their upper half of their body, the scary part of their body, from the rest of the body. And from there, we're able to extract venom and blood. And that was all sort of learned within my first year as a PhD student, both in the field and then within a lab setting. And then was just sort of thrown into it with that training, along with the collaborators that we have in Mexico and some other researchers who were able to come with us. And we just went over the course of 3-4 years, we just went to these islands. Typically, we'd go out for about a month, 2 weeks to a month at a time to the Baja region. And we travel to islands. We often camp on these islands. These islands are very remote. Most of them have no human inhabitants whatsoever, no infrastructure whatsoever. So they're pretty harsh, rugged environments. They're difficult to access. You have to access them through by boat, which you typically just arrive to a smaller town or village, and you find a fisherman who's willing to take you out there. And oftentimes we'll camp out there, or sometimes we'll just go out there and we'll come back in the same night. And these are really beautiful islands. Most of them are national parks within Mexico, so we work closely with the Mexico's like National Park Service and their sort of equivalent of Fish and Wildlife Service to ensure that we're doing everything properly. And they often join us on these expeditions and such. So, the logistics of getting out to these islands and sampling these snakes is certainly one of the most challenging aspects of the fieldwork, but certainly one of the most rewarding aspects of the research project in general.
And so when you collect the venom, I was reading you have a beaker with parafilm, which is this waxy kind of substance that almost is like saran wrap, but you can, it's actually, P.S., my favorite lab. Everybody has their own favorite lab equipment or their favorite lab item. And that's I love parafilm.
I like that. I've never thought about a favorite lab equipment.
Do you not have a favorite lab equipment?
I don't know that I do. I'm going to have to think about that.
Yeah,
now.
Think about that. Parafilm's my favorite. So you take that and you like, are you holding the rattlesnake's head and then you put its fangs into the parafilm?
Yeah. So we take the parafilm, just like you said, that's exactly what we use as parafilm. Maybe that should be my favorite as well, because I do use it a lot. We take that parafilm and we stretch it over a sample cup.
Uh-huh.
I think we literally use urine cups from a hospital. That's just what we get that work. So we take parafilm and we stretch it over these sample cups. And then the snakes, once we capture them, we typically get them in these tubes where the first half of their body's in the tube and then the second half is outside of the tube. We'll take a blood sample from the tail because we do genetics work as well. But then what we do is there's sort of two methods. One method is if your tube is long enough, you allow the snake's head to crawl all the way to the other end of the tube while you're holding, of course, the end of the tube without the snake head. And you present that cup with the parafilm to them, and then they'll sort of, with sometimes with some motivation, sometimes not, they'll strike that parafilm. And then that feeling for them, that sensation of being able to pierce, something that allows them to release the venom into that sample cup. And then we take that venom from the sample cup and we place it into just a regular kind of laboratory sample tube. Other method, while they're in the tube, sometimes if it's hard to get them to bite without us having better control of them, we'll actually back them out of the tube slowly and then sort of grab their head in a controlled fashion. So you back them out slowly, and then once their head is there, you hold them with your thumb, index, and middle finger, with your index on top of their head, and then your thumb and middle finger behind the glands. And that method, obviously, you have maintained a little more control over the snake, but it takes a lot more sort of practice to be able to do that effectively, because one mistake and the head is right there. So I definitely say all this with a very cautionary tone. Nobody should go out and try this on their own or anything like that.
No, PSA, don't do this.
Do not try this on your own. You have to get certifications and training to do that, and that's what we did that a part of my sort of training experience in the lab. But so that's sort of the experience in getting the venom from them. And then what we'll do is we'll actually dry that venom. In the lab, we use it with with a really strong vacuum. In the field, we do what we can to dry it using basically a container with some silica crystals. And then you place the tubes in there and you suck out all the air. And then that creates that pressure environment. It dries out the venom and it kind of turns into a powder or a crystal that's a little more stable and you can take home and analyze.
So you do analyze the venom. And would you say that the venom, what you're looking at, are proteins?
Yeah. So the venom is composed of these toxin proteins. So that's exactly what we're looking at.
And then I was really interested that you actually use the Shannon Diversity Index in order to estimate venom complexity. Can you tell us a little bit about that, what that is, and how you used it in the study?
Yeah, so Shannon Diversity Index, normally in ecology, it's more of a habitat biodiversity metric that we use. Mm-hmm. So you look at both the number of species present as well as the abundance of those species within that area to measure sort of complexity of species or diversity of species in a habitat. So this has been used with venom for quite a while now. It was first, I want to say about 10 years ago that somebody first sort of used this in a venom system. And so really the different venom proteins represent the number of kind of different species within the diversity index. So that's sort of how they translate. You have the number of species, which is the number of different toxins. And then the abundance of those species is just the abundance of that venom within the abundance of that toxin within that venom.
And then we'll kind of skip over some of the more complex statistical analyses, but basically you are using models that take into account multiple different variables. So without going into the mathematics behind it, can you just explain how you use those models to get the data that we're seeing?
Yeah, so we use essentially a modification of a regression. So just looking at the relationship of X to Y with that regression. And we use what's called a multiple, like mixed effects, a random effects multivariate regression. Basically, it's a way that we can look at how multiple variables and their sort of interaction with one another contribute to another variable. So in this case, we have these different island metrics. We have island area, we have island distance from the mainland, we have the age of the island, we have the number of competitors on the island. We want to see how all of those contribute to venom complexity. But if we just treat them all independently, well, we're kind of ignoring some of the nuance that happens in a real ecological system, right? Those factors aren't always independent of one another, and they interact with each other too. And so doing that basically allowed us to look at how each of these variables best explains, how they explain venom complexity, which variables best explain venom complexity, in sort of this single model that captures that interaction among variables and, some of those more complex ecological interactions.
That brings us to figure three. So how about you walk us through the different panels in figure three here?
Yeah, so figure three really serves more as a visual representation of our results from our mixed effects, multiple regression results. So what we have in panels A through C, those are really just visual representations of just simple regressions. Like I said, these representations don't actually capture the complex interactions that are found in the sort of more complex model, but they do allow us to visualize the trends. And so that's why it was important to include here, is to be able to look at these trends. And so in panel A, that's looking and sort of corresponding to our hypotheses, this was island area and venom complexity. So using our complex model, we simulated some data. That's the gray points that are found within panels A through C, and then the colored points correspond to actual data within our actual snakes. And so what we see in A through C is the results of that model of the best factors that explain venom complexity being island area, isolation, and competition. So age was not found as a factor, but we did find a negative relationship between distance and venom complexity, which is what we predicted in our hypothesis. And then the strongest negative relationship between competition and venom complexity. So that was the kind of the most important factor in explaining that venom complexity change. But then what was surprising is we found a negative relationship with island area and venom complexity. That was not what we hypothesized and not what we expected. So that's what we see with A through C, and we'll talk a little bit more about what those mean, I'm sure. But before I get ahead of myself, with D through F, these are this is just a way for us to still visualize these results, but capture those interactions just a little bit better. So since we had these three factors, the competition, area, and distance that best explain venom complexity, we form these contour plots to look at the interaction at least between two of those variables at a time. So in D, we have area and distance, and the circles themselves are the actual islands, and the shading of those circles represents the average venom complexity. And then the shading of the squares, that simulated data. And so we can see those trends still, that there's that negative relationship between area and distance, with those cooler mm-hmm. colors up in the top right, with larger and more distant islands and a less complex venom up there, mm-hmm. with a larger and more distant island, and a higher venom complexity in smaller and closer islands. Mm-hmm. And then same with E, we have competition and area, and F, distance and competition. So those, all three of these really are just ways for us to visualize the trends that we're seeing from our model results, that complex model.
Very good. And it looks like you did, as you mentioned earlier, collect four different species. And there I am seeing, especially in panel A, that the, Pyrus?
Yeah.
And that one kind of has, you see that their data points here are in the most lower right hand part of that graph, seemingly to drive that negative correlation.
Yeah, that is a great observation, and one that when we saw that, you know, we initially thought this might maybe this single island, right? Because that's just a single island over there, with those species or those individuals sampled, those snakes individuals sampled over there. Thought maybe that's driving the entire interaction. So then the supplemental material of this paper, we actually redid everything with that island excluded as well to make sure that this island wasn't driving that relationship, especially with island area, since it is such a larger island than the rest of the islands in our system. And when we did remove it, we found the same relationship. At least, you know, some of the terms, of course, how much they explain changed a little bit, but at least the trend was still there. There's negative relationship between area, distance, and competition with venom complexity. So
very, very good. Well, thank you for explaining that part to us, because, and for those of you that don't know, a lot of times we do have supplemental figures that may not have been able to be published as part of the main paper, but it's extra information that you can actually glean. If you ever get into a peer-reviewed paper and they say that they're supplemental material, it's something that you should dig into, especially if you're interested in it. Okay, so in the discussion, moving into this discussion, can you give us a very brief summary of the punchline of your study?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say the title provides a good, I guess, punchline of it, with this competition and area and distance driving venom complexity rapidly, right? So from our discussion, or from our results, we found that venom complexity was actually best predicted by island area, distance, and competition, and it was a negative relationship. So two of our hypotheses were correct, and then one was incorrect in the opposite direction. And then one was incorrect in that it wasn't a significant predictor at all. So going with island area, what we think might be happening here, and again, in an ideal world, we'd be able to go out and actually find, you know, what's going on in this. But we think that on these larger islands, we're probably seeing a little bit more habitat heterogeneity. In other words, we're seeing some more unique habitats on those larger islands. And that can drive potential increased competition, maybe competition with these other snakes, perhaps competition with other species that are inhabiting the islands as well. Again, with that habitat, maybe there's, on these really large islands, you have part of the habitat is a flat sandy dune, and then part of the habitat is this big kind of rocky canyon. And so these larger islands can support these differing habitats, and perhaps one species is able to maybe adapt better to certain parts of that island, certain habitats of that island, which restricts them to certain dietary items. So even though there may be greater species biodiversity, perhaps it's leading to increased competition or increased specialization in these species. And then, you know, isolation sort of follows what we predicted. There's potentially fewer number of dietary items or different dietary items on these more distant islands, so reduced venom complexity. And then as far as competition goes, that sort of goes into what we predicted as far as specialization. You know, that competition promotes specialization and niche partitioning, as it's often referred in ecology, where species, you know, specialize on certain in certain habitats or certain species in terms of their prey. So those are, I guess, the kind of the main discussion points as part of the results. The age aspect, that's another thing that's curious. It could indicate, one, that venom is evolving really rapidly, and that it doesn't matter how old the island is or how young the island is. It could be that age, we had to use age of the islands, but we don't actually know when the snakes colonized these islands. The snakes could have colonized these islands rather recently, and they could have also gone extinct on the island and then recolonized later. So age of the islands may not be the best predictor of age in terms of when these snakes colonized the islands, but we're going to have to look at some additional material, some additional data to try and understand colonization timing. And that's where genetics is going to come into play. And that's really our next big step. And what I'm working on right now is I've recently sequenced genomes of every single one of the animals in these studies. And now we're going to look at these patterns of island biogeography theory in terms of genetic diversity, as well as things such as colonization timing or migration between the islands, right? These islands are sometimes, they're closer to one another at times than they are to the mainland. So perhaps there's migration occurring between these islands. And so genetic data will certainly provide a little bit more information for us in this picture.
So that actually reminds me of, I don't know if you've looked up the work of Dr. Gabriele Gentili. He's actually at the University of Rome Tor Vergata, and he studies pink iguanas in the Galapagos. So a lot of his work has done very similar things. So you might want to look up some of his work, because he's asked a lot of the same questions in terms of how did pink iguanas evolve. And they live in a very specific spot on one of the islands. So, but anyways, and speaking of age of the islands, so did I see in the paper that the oldest is 4,000 years old, or is it old? Like, what is the age of, like, for example, the oldest island?
You know, I will have to look. I know older than 4,000 for sure, in the millions. Let me see if I can find what I said in that. But we definitely have islands within the I think the Miocene was our oldest island, if I remember correctly. But no, there are some islands that are relatively young and new, but there are some very old islands as well in this system. And yeah, certainly older than a few thousand off the top of my head. I'm trying to remember what
that's
we had.
Okay.
Been a second since.
Well, and we're not geologists, so.
Yeah, exactly.
but that's where geologists come in.
Exactly.
I was thinking if the islands, you know, especially the ones that are younger, are quite young in terms of geologic time, you know, maybe there just hasn't been enough time for them to show that as a signal as being important. And of course, that's where colonization comes in, right? Because the island is, you know, tens of millions of years old doesn't mean that the rattlesnakes have been there the whole time either, which is what you were alluding to before.
Yeah. I will mention my PI, Dr. Mark Margris, his work on these Florida islands has been provide us a little bit more of insight into that, because these Florida barrier islands are a lot younger. They're really only thousands of years old. Mm-hmm. And so his work sort of showed that venom can evolve rapidly on these islands, since he found a lot of differences in these venoms across island and mainland sites. So the venom can evolve rapidly. But like you said, yeah, we don't know when these snakes actually colonized these islands, how long they've been there, whether they recolonized. So using that genetic data going forward will hopefully provide us a little more insight into their colonization and the amount of time they've been on those islands.
So what do you think that this work can tell us about increasingly fragmented habitats? And do you have any advice for conservation biologists or urban management?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and when I say this, I have to be rather careful because this is a single system and a single study. And so, you know, the premise of our paper was really looking at habitat fragmentation and how traits may evolve on fragmented habitats. So based on our results, you know, I think when we're thinking of conservation and habitat fragmentation, there's the argument of single large or several small. I think SLOS is what they got, single large or several small, yeah. And so what we may have, what our results at least may suggest is that although large islands may be able to harbor or to promote greater species biodiversity, it may actually lead to a reduction in functional biodiversity. And that functional biodiversity is important for future evolvability, especially in the rapidly changing environments that we're experiencing nowadays. That raw functional trait variation is really the building blocks for evolution to act upon in later times. And so by having more diverse functional trait variation, you know, there's greater potential evolvability to the rapid changes that are happening. So although habitat size, it may promote that species diversity, it could actually not be the best for promoting functional biodiversity. Whereas maintaining perhaps more habitats that are not as isolated from one another, so having more connected habitats, that may promote both species biodiversity and functional biodiversity. But again, that is based on the results we found in a single system and a single trait. And, you know, it, we would hope that we could continue to expand this research into other systems and other traits to see if we find similar patterns.
And speaking of, what do you plan on doing next?
Yeah, so I'm getting towards the end of my PhD. The last thing I'm doing with, at least for now in this system, as part of my, I guess, my dissertation, would be the genomics. So looking at that genetic diversity and how it's changing across these islands as well, and whether it can be predicted by island biogeography theory. So we have that genetic data, and that's what I'm currently looking at now. You know, and this region offers a lot, and that we have collected a lot of data. And so that genetic data is going to allow us to look at a lot of different things on these islands. Another thing we've collected is, although we can't precisely calculate diet of all these snakes on these islands, we can estimate it, and we can do that using stable isotopes. So that's another method where you can actually look potentially at dietary diversity based on nitrogen and carbon isotopes within their, you know, just within their blood, kind of serving as markers for what potential diet and the trophic level of what they're eating is. And so at least signatures of that, and that's data that we've also found. So we have a ton of data right now with these islands, and we're just trying to utilize it to answer the most questions that we certainly can about this system and about the evolution of traits and genetic diversity on islands.
So some of these results supported the island biogeography theory and some didn't. What are your biggest unanswered questions when it comes to island biogeography theory?
Yeah, I think in terms of traits, especially since we're concerned with these functional traits across fragmented habitats, I think one unanswered question that we really need to find is what is actually causing area to have a negative relationship with the venom complexity? Is that something we see in other functional traits? Is that you know, something that we'd see in other systems as well? So, and then just determining, you know, what might be causing that, whether we can identify if it's some sort of specialization or something like that. I think in addition to that, I think although we've looked at this across islands, I think looking across this in real habitat, like fragmented habitats on the mainland, where there are very clear human effects, I think that would be interesting. And one of my lab mates is actually currently doing that in the Amazon rainforest, looking at different, basically venom complexity due to different levels of human disturbance within areas of the Amazon rainforest. So yeah, I think that's another avenue to explore is, does this actually occur as well on fragmented habitats that have been disrupted by human influence?
And finally, where can we find you on the socials?
Oh boy, on the socials. Well, currently you can find me on the Margris Lab page. and look at a bit more on the research that we do there. I am on Facebook and Instagram, although my socials and other are not, I'm not as active in posting what I do, at least across other social media platforms. But for now, the Margris Lab is the best way to find information about the research that I'm doing and the research that the lab that we have at University of South Florida is doing, and, you know, links to our publications and things like that.
Very good. Well, I'll link that in the episode description. Thank you so much for your time today, Sam, and I wish you the very best of luck with your PhD and finishing that up. I know how it's a bit of a daunting task, but you'll be so satisfied when you're done.
Absolutely. Yep. It's been hard, but I've enjoyed the process. So thank you so much for talking with me today and for sharing my paper.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Have a good day.
You as well.